You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot-button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly. Welcome to another edition of Cyber Law and Business Report. We're broadcasting live here from the Internet Law Center in downtown Santa Monica, the heart of Silicon Beach. Please be seated. We have a great show for you today. This is probably the only talk show in Los Angeles not talking about LeBron James. But our focus today is on Sacramento. And there's a famous quote that laws are like sausages, cease to inspire respect in proportion as we know how they are made. And that's John Godfrey Sachs. And today we're going to talk about the legislative process in California, state capital of Sacramento. And we have, in a period of a few days, we've had a rapid succession of an privacy bill that went from dead to law in a matter of 7 days. We have a net neutrality bill that went from with strong support to dead to back live and viable and seemingly destined for passage in a matter of a week. And then we've had an email bill that was pitched as just a clarification of existing law, but was actually a total Christmas present to plaintiffs' lawyers, inched through the assembly and now is inching towards passage in the Senate. And so we're going to be talking about each of those three landmark bills. And we understand that to an extent, this is kind of like those videos you see of Shakespeare in 10 minutes or less. But we have a good panel today to kind of help us grasp what's going on here. And we're joined by Jared Gordon, and Jared is with McCormick Barstow in Fresno, and also with us is Joshua De La Rose Hyman at Data Law in San Francisco. So, gentlemen, are you with us?
It's great to be here.
Yes.
And so, thank you for joining us, and with the constraints that we have, you know, obviously we can't. We're doing somewhat of a Cliff Notes version of what's going on. But why don't we start first with this landmark privacy bill? The California Consumer Privacy Act of 2008. And for listeners, we have details on each of these bills in our show notes, which are at cyberlawradio.wordpress.com. And as always, follow us on Twitter at cyberlawradio. So AB 375 was inactive in late June, and then in a matter of 7 days, it becomes law. How did that happen?
So, this is Josh. It happens in the way that sausage is made. My understanding is that there was a very wealthy real estate mogul who has a passion for privacy. And he had created a proposition for the California ballot, which had much of this language in it. And he said that he was going to run it as a proposition so that it would be run in that process. He then went to the California legislature and said, I am going to have this unless you pass something very similar to what I have on my proposition. The California legislature worked with him and came up with this 10,000 word plus bill as a way of placating him so he wouldn't run the proposition. Now, this is how this became our law in 7 days.
It's astounding, yeah, Jared.
I'll add a little bit more color to that process, if you don't mind, Josh. So my understanding is that part of the reason that it was so accelerated is that the final day of passage, which was, I think, last Thursday, that was the final day on which the backer of the initiative could withdraw the initiative. So everything had to happen by then. He was clear that it had to be signed into law by the governor in order for him to be comfortable withdrawing his initiative. And so it was all a matter of everyone accelerating their timetables in Sacramento in order to meet this initiative withdrawal deadline. And amazingly, the legislature actually did it. I was surprised they managed to move as fast as they did, even though it was clear that there was some broad deal and agreement cut to avoid his initiative.
The result hasn't been exactly universally welcomed. Professor Eric Goldman from Santa Clara Law, whom you guys are familiar with, said the result is a sweeping, lengthy, 10,000 words, insanely complicated, and poorly drafted privacy regulation that will govern the world's fifth largest economy. Needless to say, this rushed and non-inclusive process created a law with many defects, ranging from typos and drafting errors to terrible policy ideas. But other than that, sounds like he loves it.
And the only criticism I would have of Professor Goldman's views on that is that it won't just govern California's economy. That might be true in some very technical sense, but as we all know, what happens to the internet in California effectively happens to at least all of the United States, and probably to the internet as a whole across the world.
So, Jared, go ahead.
I would just like to say that Eric Goldman actually said that a privacy bomb is about to be dropped on the California economy and the global internet. So, I think he expects it to affect everyone.
And so help us get our arms around what exactly this does. I've heard this is GDPR-like. Josh, what would you say?
So, I'd say that's definitely one element of it. GDPR governs consumer data in the European Union. And this was definitely inspired partially on GDPR compliance. But it's also been inspired on other elements too, including the Cambridge Analytica abuses, whereby Facebook and other social media groups were abused by the Russians during the election. And it was also based on the Equifax breaches. So the idea was to cure those three things in one giant mega bill. I think it's the best way I can describe it. And when you try to cram that much stuff into one thing, you get a very muddled law.
And it sounds like this isn't done in this, even though it is passed as law. It doesn't go to effect until January 2020. So I have a feeling much of 2019 in Sacramento is going to be either clarifying this law or postponing the effective date, or both.
I think you're absolutely correct. There's so much ambiguity and confusion in this as written. that it'd be very difficult to enforce. One thing it does do is it both empowers and funds the California Attorney General's office to interpret and to give advice to companies and those affected by it. So they clearly understand there's a lot of ambiguity here.
And so what are you telling clients about this? How are they reacting?
My clients are utterly dumbfounded by this because they spent a lot of money under the GDPR compliance process. So to have this, which is another ambiguous standard that they need to comply with, is flummoxing.
Yep. Can we gonna stop for a second? Josh?
Yes.
Do you have a landline we can call you at? The sound is awful.
I'm sorry. Let me try a solution here.
Because we're getting like feedback and echo.
Yeah, let me try. I'm gonna hang up. Is there a number I should call?
No, we can call you. Ricky, are you there?
So
you're not getting anything on your end. Josh, are you hearing an echo or feedback?
I'm hearing a vague echo.
A vague. What a lordly thing. It's within the penumbra of the echo.
It comes and goes, I think.
It does.
Do you hear it now?
I hear like a zzz. Maybe that's my headset. I don't know. Josh, are you hearing?
I was hearing it a little bit earlier. It comes and goes. Let me try moving around a little bit.
Okay.
Is that better?
I just hear, and every time you stop, there's like a zzz. Do you hear that, Josh?
I was getting a little bit of it. It was worse before. It seems better, but there's some noticeable still in the background.
And you're not hearing it, Ricky? Okay. All right, we'll just have to do it. I'm sorry? Okay, that's good. All right, let's plot along. I'm sorry. So you, let me just remember where you were. You just finished what you're telling your clients that it's a muddled mess. Jared, what's your take? How are you telling your client? Are you just telling them, if you happen to have time at the beach this weekend, here's some nice 10,000-word reading?
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that because I actually have had zero questions about it so far. I think my clients just don't even know about it yet, and I haven't sent out a notice to people because I feel like I don't understand the new law's terms well enough to really be able to inform my clients as to what they need to do under AB 375. I mean, it's such a muddled mess that, you know, it will probably be weeks before I understand enough how it's going to impact my different clients to be able to give them some kind of personalized notice. And I think given the sort of complexity of the law and the mishmash of different privacy-related ideas that are stuck into this, I'm not sure that it's that helpful to send out a sort of broad, generalized description, at least to a lot of my clients. They'll care about particular provisions that impact them highly, but who will be impacted by what provisions, I think, varies quite a bit from the to the extent that I understand what the new requirements are, at least as of 2020.
Now, one of the criticisms, that, you know, if you're familiar with Mike Masnick at TechDirt, he says it takes an insanely broad view of what is personal information. Do you guys have a sense? Do you agree with that? Or
I definitely agree, and I think that's part of the problem in terms of figuring out even who and what aspects of a business it applies to. Just given the sheer scope of what kind of information is covered, it makes personal data under GDPR look like a limited definition.
And one of the other, when you guys talk about the problems you have with the bill, what are some of the other provisions that are going to make people, you know, swallow hard.
Well, one element I think that will make people swallow hard is that there is a new cause of action, a private cause of action for security breaches. And whenever you enter a new private cause of action, you'll see class actions relating to these. So that's going to be something that you'll hear a lot about as it fleshes out.
Well, and also it's not just class actions, as Jared and I know very well. It's people who will make a living out of getting claims and finding willing plaintiffs, you know, to just repeatedly sue people over this. Which is, that's what we've seen in the spam context.
It'll be this plus.
So we're starting to see that. We're starting to see that in the GDPR as well. We're seeing things that are called GDPR trolls.
Yeah.
So, as this is an analogous to the GDPR, I suspect we'll see that as well.
And is there any? So we had the proposition, I believe it was 78, that passed that changed, you know, the business and the professions code. That to require that in certain consumer redress cases, the consumer actually have to show harm. Is this going to be subject to Prop 78, or does it somehow circumvent that?
That's a great question, and I don't think it's clear at this point.
Because that's an important point. I mean, that was basically a proposition that passed designed to address basically, you know, nuisance litigation. And if they can circumvent that here, you know what's going to happen.
You could, I think, see the kind of splits that you're seeing at the federal level on Spokio standing issues relating to personal data breaches, where some courts come down in favor of the idea that merely having that information disclosed or not complying with this law is an injury, because essentially the California legislature says that there's this right that you have under this law, and any injury to that law is an injury in fact. I think there will be other courts that probably will come down the other way, particularly to the extent that it's pretty clear that it's a, you know, professional plaintiff, where courts are, I think, maybe sometimes more willing to try to find standing reasons to get rid of them. I mean, that's more true at the federal level, but.
Well, one last question before we break, and that is, you know, the last time California enacted a major law that kind of reshaped the internet, it was in 2003 when they passed the law banning spam, and Congress stepped in with the 82 days to say no, sorry, and they passed the Can Spam Act to take effect the very day that the California law would have gone to effect. So, you know, we don't have to actually see a rush to action, since this won't go into effect until 2020. But do you think there's any likelihood that Congress may step in and try to create either clearer or a more watered down version of the California law?
In a normal Congress, I would say yes.
It's good. I take that as a no. Jared?
I agree that it would be good policy. I think actually, even independent of this new law, it would make sense for Congress to address that, only because of GDPR. And I think that there's, on a long-term level, that there's probably some need for the U.S. to harmonize with Europe in a more holistic fashion, the way in which we handle privacy, so that we stop ending up in the, you know, repeated problems with Privacy Shield and all of those sorts of issues. So there probably is some multi-year, multilateral negotiations that'll have to go on to address that. I wonder whether there's enough time, even with the January 1, 2020 deadline, to get legislation passed by Congress.
It's tight. That's a complex issue. Yeah, in a short time. We need to harmonize with our advertisers. So We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more about Sacto Gone Wild after these messages.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Ready to do a podcast for your business? Make that podcast elevate to enterprise level. Let WebmasterRadio.fm expedite and execute your podcast to build your brand and broaden your customer base. WebmasterRadio.fm has worked with the world's biggest tech brands, Google, Yahoo, and Bing, and have worked with fast-growing brands like ShipStation and GoDaddy. Now it's your turn. Contact BRASCO at WMR.fm and rush your enterprise-level podcast into production at a very reasonable rate. Email BRASCO at WMR.fm.
Looking for a better way to get more traffic and interaction to your Facebook page? Imagine Facebook interactivity on your page like you've never seen. Introducing your new Facebook marketing fix, ZoSocial, the new and revolutionary way to easily manage and automate your Facebook contests and sweepstakes. Create a fun, easy-to-win contest by writing a simple Facebook post. Watch your post go more viral and generate loads of interaction. Track your traffic and generate email lists with ease. ZoSocial is mobile-friendly and complies with Facebook terms of service. Let ZoSocial give your Facebook page some flash today. Zoom over to ZoSocial.com.
Are you looking for the best in WordPress speed, security, and scalability? WP Engine is a digital experience platform for WordPress, powering digital experiences for large brands around the world. With easy-to-use site management tools and powerful do-it-your-way development features, WP Engine gives you the flexibility to build it your way. Improve your SEO and conversion rates with a faster site on WP Engine. Learn more on WPEngine.com.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back and we're talking about the latest rash of legislation, from privacy to net neutrality to email legislation. And we have a very distinguished panel. Jared, why don't you tell us just a brief minute or so about what you, who you are and what you do.
So again, I'm Jared Gordon. I'm of counsel at McCormick Barstow. In my prior career, I was in-house counsel at an online advertising network and at a Facebook games company. And now my practice primarily involves either representing e-commerce companies or representing companies that do business both on and offline, and assisting them with their online regulatory compliance, e-commerce terms and conditions, and complex, like high-stakes, high-value transactions.
And Jared is calling in from Fresno, where one of our most loyal listeners lives. And in addition, we had Josh. Why don't you just tell us about your practice in a minute or so?
Absolutely. My name is Joshua Delarios-Hyman. I am the managing director of Data Law in San Francisco, which is a boutique law firm that deals with data-driven clients. I work predominantly with technology companies and funders to build privacy-based products and technology solutions. Mostly my practice these days involves general data protection regulation compliance and helping companies comply with the European regulations while they're in the United States. Every couple of months, the practice changes, but the overarching theme of my practice is connecting data and the law and helping companies get what they need to get done.
All right. Well, thank you for that. I'm sorry.
There was a bunch of static. I don't know if you heard.
Don't reference that while we're on the air. Okay. Let's take a pause. Ricky, when you go back, if you can just delete that last Yeah. And all right. So just if you have an issue, guys, just say break, pause 5 seconds, and then say what the issue is. And then that way we can flag it when we post this. All right. So we talked about the privacy bill, and now the next bill is the Net Neutrality Act. And the California Internet Consumer Protection and Net Neutrality Act of 2008 that went from steaming to passage to dead to steaming to passage in an equally short period of time. And which one of you guys wants to tell us how that happened?
Well, I'll say on my end that I was actually not at all surprised that there was, you know, sort of a renewed interest in it. To me, I was surprised that it didn't pass faster, given that De Leon is the sponsor. I mean, that's a lot of juice behind the bill. And I'd always kind of expected, given the importance of net neutrality to the Democrats' platform on tech issues, that this bill was going to pass. It was a surprise to me that it took as long as it did to get through the Senate.
And California is one of 36 states trying to pass their own net neutrality laws. And the bill put forward by Senate President De Leon, who's also running for Senate against Senator Feinstein, was called the gold standard by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And it kind of got railroaded. There's a hearing. It came before, after passing the Senate, it came before the Assembly Communications Committee, and Chairman Miguel Santiago pushed through a whole series of amendments that gutted the bill without even hearing any testimony. And so there was a big backlash against him. So, you know, he's a Democrat, and they felt that he had betrayed his own party. And he ultimately folded and agreed to restore everything, but it was a remarkable development. But let's talk about the framework. The FCC net neutrality order, which just went into effect, reverses the prior net neutrality order by the Obama team under Chairman Wheeler, and which was upheld by the D.C. Circuit. So now this new net neutrality order claims to preempt state law. So there's a question about whether these laws are even permissible. But that never seems to stop states from doing what they want to do anyway. But it can't preempt states from acting in their role as a buyer. And that's one of the things you see in these laws is, with Montana being the first to act, is directing that public funds can't be used to purchase services from companies that violate these net neutrality standards. What's your take on that? Josh?
Well, the Dormant Commerce Clause concern of having 49 different net neutrality laws, or including California's, is something that is a legitimate concern for the federal government. But that being said, the idea that you can just, with a regulation, negate the rights of the states to have a net neutrality or in their purchasing is really a difficult question that really is a good federal question. And again, this is a congressional problem where we don't have a good Congress. So that is going to be an issue the courts are going to have to decide.
Well, and actually, since you, funny you mentioned Congress, because there actually is a petition in Congress to reverse the PI internet order. And that passed the Senate, and they have until the end of this year to get it through the House, and which would then reverse the new rule. But that there hasn't been a vote on that, and it doesn't seem like one's likely to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, I think it's going to be stuck in the House, and it won't end up getting out of the House. That's my understanding of the practical politics of it. And I think part of the problem, and it's really unfortunate because the Obama administration decided to push through net neutrality using the FCC, and maybe this was Chairman Wheeler, the FCC wanted to do it, and this was the only way that was within the FCC's potential powers to do it this way. But he did it by imposing Title II utility categorization on internet service providers, and that creates a whole host of other issues that on a policy level are both, I think, unnecessary and undesirable for internet service providers and probably for the internet generally. I think in many ways the California law is much better in that it avoids that problem. If I had been the one advising the seven Democrats, which I certainly wasn't, what I would have suggested is that they not do anything like what they're doing, which is to try and reverse the reversal of the regulation by Chairman Pai, but instead that they just affirmatively adopt net neutrality principles by statute at the federal level, and they would avoid 90% of the problems with the way that the federal net neutrality order was put in place by the FCC, and they probably would avoid a lot of opposition as well.
I mean, I think there's a valid point to having ping pong the internet policy that, okay, so we have net neutrality for the next 4 or 8 years, and then, okay, well, now it's Republican administration. We have the exact opposite. Although, I think this order, unlike, you know, the standard under, you know, Chairman Powell and others, other under Republican administrations, who at least espouse the principles of net neutrality, and, you know, it was, the question was, how should it be enforced, you know, whether it should be, you know, through the Article II or not, what you're, or Title II or not. What you're seeing with Ajit Pai's order is he's actually saying, you know, not upholding the net neutrality principles at all. He's saying you can throttle, you can do all these things that for a decade we've been saying is wrong, as long as you disclose it. And in some markets, there's no choice. What happens if there's only one or two choice options? And they both say, hey, yeah, we're both going to throttle you. We're both going to do this other thing. How does that protect consumers? And so I think that's often lost in debate. This is not just really about reversing the Obama-era net neutrality. It's actually just rejecting the whole concept of net neutrality.
You're right. And in many ways, I think it puts it something closer to the previous FTC regulation approach, which is, you know, going to be oriented around whether or not there's disclosure that's adequate and truthful representations, as opposed to you know maybe meaningfully bad service that is contrary to expectations, as long as those, you know, expectations are in some way tempered by notice.
And Josh, what's your take on this?
I think the most concerning element of all of this is that the companies who are involved in this are going to only be able to plan on the short term, with the assumption that in the next administration, if it switches over, net neutrality will be back, or it may not. So there's never that certainty you need for long-term planning. And these are massive, massive organizations that are building these things. So that is a huge problem. And if you have to do it across 50 states and everyone is different, it's going to cost the consumer a huge amount of money every time you flip.
Right. And the, you know, the issue, as you mentioned, and so the FCC has a role, and I think that's part of the reason why this is encouraged, is to expand broadband deployment. You know, that is part of its mission, according to Congress. And so if ISPs are somehow afraid to invest because they don't know what the policy is going to be 2, 4, 6 years down the road, that runs counter to the FCC's mission.
Absolutely.
So would it be fair to say that the big winners in this, all these state legislative efforts, are one, the tech lobbyists, who are definitely going to be being quite busy across the country, but eventually it's going to be all the lawyers and the communications lawyers who have to litigate this about whether or not they're preempted?
Yeah, I think we'll be looking at least 40 field preemption and dormant commerce clause challenges, depending on how many states end up passing some version of net neutrality, which, you know, I think it's likely California will pass one, and probably most of the rest of the states considering it will eventually get around to it before it gets to the appellate level and gets knocked down.
But there actually, there's one issue that's interesting here. It's kind of a karma issue, you might say, is that, excuse me, the same day that the Wheeler FCC adopted the net neutrality principles and enforceable under Title II, they also adopted a rule preempting some state rules that restricted the ability of municipalities to offer broadband. In essence, they were anti-competitive efforts. ISP lobbies getting a hold of state capitals and saying stop these municipalities from competing with us, and so they preempted that, and the ISPs fought it and won and said the FCC can't preempt those laws, and so will that precedent hurt their ability to, in this case, have the ISPs that has their victory in the prior case, is that going to come back and haunt them here?
I think that they will haunt the small ISPs, but the larger ones will be able to use that as an advantage and a way of end gaming around. It's like the Google.
Right. Will that precedent prevent them now from saying because the question is, can the FCC preempt these laws? And so ISPs won in round one, but does round one mean they lose in the bigger fight?
But in a sense, those might be very different questions because federal rules that prohibit a state legislature from creating a law or taking even a policy position, maybe not strictly in a statutory sense, those are largely prohibited because of the separation of states from the federal government as dual sovereigns, and there's case law going back to, I think it's New York versus U.S., which is a toxic waste case from the, I think, late 80s, where the Supreme Court's repeatedly held, and I think there's actually even a case from this past term, although I can't remember off the top of my head which one it was, but the Supreme Court's repeatedly held that the federal government can't tell state legislatures what laws they can and can't pass, but they can preempt the state legislative laws so that regardless of what the law is, maybe it's not enforced, right? I mean, that I think that's an important distinction to draw, that the federal telecommunications laws could be sufficient that they would cover the entire field and prevent state-level enforcement. I don't think that's the case, given that there's still pretty extensive state-level franchising rules and other telecommunications rules that are specific within states, but something like this would be a harder call.
So we're going to shift to our third topic, which is a commercial email law, and that was pitched. I went through and looked at the initial hearings, and it was pitched by advocates as a minor change to close loopholes and provide clarification of existing law. And in reality, it was just a giveaway to the spam lawyers, so they could basically reverse cases that they had lost on and then broadly expand their ability to sue. And Jared, you and I have worked together in trying to fight this bill. One remarkable achievement was the new California Lawyers Association, which has spun off from the California Bar, all the various sections, the intellectual property section, the business law section, actually took a position and opposed this bill, which is it was a first for I'm with the intellectual property law section, and I don't know if it's true for the business law section, but it was the first time that we had actually taken a position and opposed a bill.
I think that's true for the business section as well, at least post spinoff from the state bar. So
kudos to Jared, who took the lead in writing that opposition. But So tell us this we're going to take a break in about a minute and a half, but tell us briefly what this about this bill and how it got here.
Well, so I think your earlier summary was correct that there's a couple of plaintiffs' lawyers, particularly one very active plaintiffs' lawyer who got Assemblymember Chow to sponsor AB 2546, and it included a number of new private rights of action. It tried to separate out the body of the email from the subject line and other header information, which previously only header and subject lines have really been the subject of potential claims under California law. And it also tried to make it more difficult for various defenses that email advertisers had under case law and under the prior statute. So it was sort of a bit of a Christmas tree wish list for the email plaintiffs bar, but and it went through extremely quickly through in the assembly before starting to run into opposition in the Senate, including us.
So we're going to take a short break. We come back, we'll talk more about this email bill, and we'll give you some final announcements and wrap up and after these messages. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Do you look at the task of ranking your site at the top of the search engines like you would climbing the top of Mount Everest? It doesn't have to be. TopSEOs.com knows how hard that climb can be, and they can make top ranking a reality. Top SEOs send you to only the right search vendors and agencies that they know will work for you. Since 2002, TopSEOs.com has reviewed and researched the best search engine marketing agencies and solutions providers. Don't risk the cost of falling off the proverbial peak of search rankings. Let Top SEOs give you peace of mind. TopSEOs.com, the independent authority on search vendors.
There are over 70 million active podcast listeners in the U.S.
WebmasterRadio.fm reaches them all
with the largest global distribution of any online business-to-business podcast network. Through iHeartRadio, iTunes, Stitcher, and the WebmasterRadio.fm mobile app, we can target and place your message in front of those active listeners immediately. Now, your message can be delivered with less commitment and investment on over 20 hours of weekly original content.
Hosted by the most respected...
St. Jude continues to advance by increasing cure rates in childhood cancer. And donors are important to us because you get the feeling that you have a team behind you. When it comes to research and advancements, there are some things that only we can do because we have the resources and we have the focus. And so if St. Jude doesn't do it, who will?
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Finding cures, saving children. Learn more at stjude.org.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back, and we have an August panel here talking to us about the latest bills coming out of Sacramento that are could potentially reshape the internet. And so we're now talking about the email bill, and one of its principal proponents is a Dan Balsam. And my very first appearance on this network was in 2009 on the show Inboxed. And we talked about a case that was the host had against Balsam, and they were kind of crowing on their victory. And it resulted in a six-page letter threatening to sue unless there was a retraction, even though the comments were opinions and not defamatory or privileged under litigation privilege or protected by the First Amendment. And it led me to remind him that while it's clear you have some psychological problem with being challenged and or accepting defeat, the proper place to deal with this is a therapist's office and not in the state court system. That was my letter to him expressing my view on his six-page demand letter. So that being said, knowing he may not be too happy about what we talk about here, I see the principal problem of the bill going forward is we have been fortunate and able to get a lot of the bill stricken, including this ridiculous provision that you can't use more than one domain. But what I see the big hurdle here is to amend the bill to allow them to sue for falsity in the content and the email, because that will it will supersede existing false advertising law, which current law requires both that there be harm to the consumer and I'm forgetting one other element of it, but this will make it strictly liable and you can sue even if there's no harm. What's your take, Jared?
I think that's an accurate read of the bill, and I think it's a legitimate risk. Can spam's preemption, which has been broadly helpful, and for listeners who don't know, the Can Spam Act of 2003 is the federal law that governs email advertising, and states essentially have to write their bills, write their laws around the Can Spam Act's preemption. But its preemption is limited to things that are materially false and misleading. So it does seem to me that the California legislature probably can create a cause of action for materially false and misleading content in the body of an email as a matter of law. Now, whether that's a good policy idea, I think your point is generally right, Bennett, that it does seem to be inconsistent with the way that the California voters have previously dealt with false advertising and unfair competition law claims, that if you don't have an actual injury, you can't sue. I think it's maybe not completely clear-cut, but it does seem like it's likely that you'll be able to sue absent any actual injury.
And then that's troublesome, I think. And also, just what bothers me more also is just the way it was pitched. This is just a clarification. Oh, it doesn't really do much. When in reality, it is quite a sweeping change. And it also, I left out one other element, is the current law requires that a plaintiff demonstrate intent or reckless, that you were reckless and, regard to the truth or falsity of what's in your advertisement, and this will eliminate that. So it's just going to invite so much litigation that I know clients who are thinking about abandoning email if this bill passes.
And certainly if depending on the kind of email marketing that your clients do, I think the original version of the bill, that would have been a legitimate response before some of the amendments that have been applied by the state Senate committees. It was potentially monstrous for the internet advertising industry. I think now it's certainly gotten a lot better.
Right. I mean, but the point I would make, Jared, is that it had, and maybe it was a strategic choice. It had like 12 really repugnant things, and now it's just one or two. But at the end of the day, it's still repugnant.
Yeah, it's still absolutely problematic for the online advertising industry. I definitely agree with that. It still creates significant problems. There's probably even a few places where it arguably is going to run into various kinds of either constitutional or federal law issues, at least in some applications. But now it at least has limited some of the worst problems that it had. For instance, the most recent set of amendments dropped a provision that had required courts to treat the email header and the body separately, and the more I thought about it, the more that seemed to me like it might actually be the worst part of the bill. I think it actually posed significant commercial speech constitutional problems had it been left in, and there may still be some commercial speech issues with some aspects of this bill as it stands, particularly on an as-applied basis. But I mean, I think there were problems of, you know, potential overbreath and a potential facial challenge under commercial speech law as it's recently evolved. Had that provision been left in?
So we're right now they're in recess, and so they'll come back in August, and that's when we'll see the net neutrality bill will certainly pass quickly. But there's still a couple more fights on the email bill left. It still has to go through one more committee, then you have a Senate vote, and then it has to go back to the Assembly to approve the amendment. So The prospect for passage of net neutrality, I would say, is almost a certainty. But this bill seems uncertain at this point. Would you agree?
I agree. I think it's pretty uncertain what the Assembly is going to do with it. You know, when it went through the Assembly the first time, pre-amendment, it was rushed through. I mean, it was frankly rushed through the Senate hearing process at a rate that I don't remember seeing for any internet law bill in recent memory. And clearly that rush has stopped, and I suspect that, you know, there's going to be some time where people maybe take a breath, think about what's really going on here and whether it makes sense to make these kinds of changes. And maybe some people in the Assembly who voted yes the first time will have second thoughts and realize that they're opening up some of their constituent businesses to a world of hurt.
Now, we have... We only have a few minutes left, but we have some landmarks that have that occurred, and one of which is you may be familiar with the famous New Yorker cartoon, "On the Internet, Nobody Knows You're a Dog." That is now 25 years old. How many have you guys ever? Do you guys ever reference that to your clients or in discussions?
I do. Certainly have. Yeah.
Yeah, I would preface it now. On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog except Cambridge Analytica.
How true. I think. Please submit that too. The email. I'll find the email address for the New Yorker cartoons.
So that New Yorker cartoon is 175 years old in dog years. Is that right?
That's right. I think they do have like a. I don't know whether it's you caption something, but the New Yorker does have this thing for people to solicit comments. So that's one landmark. Also, I want to give two shout outs. Our own Webmaster Radio's own co-founder, Darren Babin, turned 50 on Monday. And we also want to thank and say happy birthday to Binay Wilson, the AV travel geek, who is a frequent guest every Thanksgiving. Happy birthday to you. So we only have a few minutes left, guys. Josh, if people want to contact you or learn more about you, where do you go? Where do they go?
You can go to my website at data-law.com or check me out at DataLawTweet on Twitter.
And Jared?
I have a much worse website. So our law firm's website is McCormick-Barstow.com. That's McCormick-Barstow.com.
And we have a link to it on the show notes. Do you have Twitter or no?
I do have Twitter, but I hate Twitter, so I personally don't use it. But I am happy to talk to people on LinkedIn, which is...
We should have had you on our last show. We talked about the toxicity of Twitter. That being noted, gentlemen, I want to thank you very much. Also, let me give you guys get a plug in. What are your roles with the business law section? Do you have titles? I just want to make sure I get them right.
We're the co-vice chairs of the Internet and Privacy Law Committee of the business section of the California Lawyers Association.
And then next year you'll be the co-chairs?
That is correct.
Assuming that we actually get a quorum together to vote for us. But yes, I think that's...
the technology, Internet and Privacy... what's the name of the subcommittee again?
It's Internet and Privacy Law Committee.
Privacy Law Committee, which used to be Cyber Law Committee, which I once co-chaired, does great stuff. If you're interested in it, check it out. In addition, I've been working closely with them in my role with the IP section. We have a subcommittee called Technology, Internet, and Privacy, and so we often do similar stuff, and we enjoy working together, and I commend both of them for the work that they've done on this, and it's been fun working with them, and I really want to thank you for coming on today. It's been great fun, and I know we kind of took a big bite tackling all these three things in 1 hour, but I think we came out okay. So thank you very much. Join us next week for another edition of Cyber Law and Business Report, and check out the Internet Law Center at internetlawcenter.net. We're a full-service internet firm. And until then, have a great week. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.